We're now going to look at the general corruption of Catholics and nominal Catholics, because in these particular quotes, there's multiple types of immoralities and crimes being committed. So I said the general corruption. And we're going to start with Peter Damian again, testifying to us in the 11th century in his letter 11 to the papal chancellor, dated 1045. Dear sir, while I am aware of what Rome is like at this time, and have also frequently heard of you, this one idea keeps recurring to me, that he who is able to grow the whitest lily among a crush of thorns, for it is certain that unless the Roman see returns to its former integrity, the whole world will remain forever in its fallen state. 11th century, Peter Damian saying the Roman see in Rome was perverted back then, and unless it returns, it'll remain, and it has. It has remained. And once it gets to such a bad point, sometimes it's more public, sometimes they keep it secret. From that point forward, it has remained. Just what he said would happen. And Peter Damian also, in his letter 165 to the hermit Albizio and the monk Peter, August 1069. The world, in fact, is daily deteriorating into such a worthless condition. Each rank of secular and ecclesiastical society has collapsed and fallen from its former state. Decency has gone. Honesty disappeared. Religious devotion has fallen on bad times. And like an army on the march, the throng of all holy virtues has withdrawn at a distance. 11th century. Not just the 14th and the 15th and 16th. This is the 11th century. All are bent on their own purposes. Philippians 2:21. For who in our day is able to find a group of laymen among whom there is not someone who is under the ban of excommunication because of his sin? He's saying they're so bad that almost all of them are banned under an automatic excommunication because of their sins. For years now, all sorts of crime have sprung up throughout the world. Every shameful act now flourishes, and daily this condition becomes more widespread. Wherefore, it is impossible for a monk who goes out among the people to avoid meeting persons who are excommunicated, or, which is nearly the same, those who should be excommunicated. Now, he goes on in here, I'm not going to go off too long, as he's talking again about non-punishmentalism and non-judgmentalism, where they don't denounce. He says, I don't care what your modern guys are saying, they need to be, to avoid them, they need to be declared by name to be excommunicated. He says, no, St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5:11, any brother who's a fornicator or a drunkard, don't even eat with them. No declaration, no sentence necessary. They're trying to pull that stuff in his day. He says, I don't care what they say. The church has always practiced, he says, from the beginning, he brings out canon laws, that these people are automatically excommunicated and must be avoided. No declaration, no sentence necessary. They're trying to pull that stuff during then, so you can stay in communion with them. So he's going, wherefore it is impossible for a monk to go out among the people to avoid meeting persons who are excommunicated, or which is nearly the same, those who should be excommunicated. Even he's saying there should be sentences against all of these, you know. Or some of them where it requires a sentence and they haven't given a sentence. For he will come in touch with murderers, perjurers, and the incestuous, arsonists, adulterers. And even if he finds them repulsive, he often greets them with a kiss. And if necessity demands, eats with them from the same dish. Even though the apostles exclaims, you must have nothing to do with any so-called Catholic, so-called Christian, who leads a loose life, is unclean, or a robber, or a drunkard. You should not eat with such persons. 1 Corinthians 5:11. He's quoting here. Say, St. Paul says, you're not even supposed to eat with a drunkard, let alone all these crimes on committed. They're all eating with one another, and they're praying with one another, and worse, they're even in religious communion with them, which is even the worst of all. Just as one must be careful to avoid the head of the reprobate himself, so too must we shun his members, except when we are trying to convert them. When you're trying to convert them and witness to them. Now we read, this was just giving you a small example from Peter Damian's letters. He has a lot of them about the massive corruption in his day. And what was the big crime back then? It was scholasticism, which is really beginning to grow, starting big back then. and not so much even the desecration of churches with images against faith or morals, which started, it did start then, but that got more rampant later on. But you're looking at the Romans 1 curse right back then because of the scholasticism. And some of them were also glorifying the mythological, well, I say mostly at that time, the pagan philosophers and all that. Later on came the glorification of mythological gods and false religions. But that alone has shown you that what the result of the scholasticism was doing to society. He also rails against scholasticism very much, Peter Damian. Now, we're reading from the History of Popes, a footnote, and it says, Villani and others also accused Clement VI of immorality. That's Clement VI of immorality. And that was from Volume 1, Page 1, Chapter 1, Page 92, and it was a footnote. Again, we're reading from the History of Popes, the horrible crimes which had been the curse of the ancient world and which were the theme of his Beccadelli's elegant verses raged like a moral pestilence in his time in the larger towns of Italy. Homosexuality, adultery, all the types of crimes that pagan Romans were committing, especially among the higher classes of society. Florence, Siena, and Naples are described as the chief seats of these excesses in the 15th century. Beccadelli had the insolence to defend himself by an appeal to the authority of the ancients. A great many learned, worthy, holy Greeks and Romans had, he said, sung of such things. And yet the works of Catullus, Tibullus, Propertius, Juvenal, Martial, Virgil, and Ovid were universally read. The very prince of philosophers, Plato himself, had written wanton verses. He says all these guys supported these immoral acts. So look, these were holy men. They're idolaters. They're pagans. See how they looked upon these men? And they were copying all the vices these guys wrote about. Beccadelli then gives a list of Greek philosophers and statesmen who had indulged in writings of this description. That was, now we're going on to read in the history of, that was Volume 1 in the History of Popes. Now we're going on to read from Volume 5 in the History of Popes. Vainglory, however, was by no means the worst of the vices which sprang from the unrestrained, self-regarded spirit which the Renaissance did so much to promote. Luxury and extravagance, deceit and fraud, vendettas, immorality, rapine and murder, religious indifference, infidelity, and petronaturalism were its boon companions. The culmination of the results of this hypothesis of selfishness was seen in some men who appeared at this time, monsters in human form, utterly ruthless, reveling in crime for its own sake, not merely using it as a means of an end, or rather using such means to compass ends even more abnormally detestable and horrible than the means themselves. To this class belonged Sigismondo Malatesta, and in a sense Cesare Borgia. But they were exceptional, and altogether the pagan humanists formed a mere faction of the Italian nation. It is, however, indisputable that the infection of their poisonous influence was widely diffused. And you can see, take a look at Malatesta's temple that had, it was the Church of St. Francis, but they called it the Malatesta Temple because it was so bad that it had hardly any holy pictures and all false gods and false religious mythological covered on the outside and the inside of his church, as you can see here from some of these pictures. That's why he called it the Temple of Malatesta, because it didn't even resemble a church at all. It was so overwhelmingly with these idolatrous images. This is from the History of Popes again, from Volume 5. The frequency of murders in churches is another mark of the blunting of the moral sense caused by the spirit of the classical Renaissance. Most of them were perpetrated by men who strove to emulate Brutus and Cassius, and the two chief heroes of the humanists. Moral corruption, such as we have been describing, could not fail to lead to religious indifference. Boccaccio's famous poem of the Three Rings is a significant expression of this tendency. The Morgante Maggiore of Luigi Pulci shows that a similar tone of thought was well received in Lorenzo de Medici's circle. The poem is a romantic tale of chivalry divided into cantos, each of which begins by invoking the inspiration of God and the saints for a muse whose utterances are nothing but a tissue of buffoonery. And the second canto, the help of the crucified Jupiter, is implored to bring the tale to a close. The fourth contains a parody of Gloria Patri and a medley of Italian and Latin verses, and another there is a parody of the Paternoster. The most profane The more profane the song, the more solemn is the prologue which introduced it. Sudden conversions and baptisms are sarcastically described and attributed to the lowest motives. Sacred things are travestied and derided. And finally, the poet winds up with a declaration of faith in the goodness of all religions, which in spite of his professions of orthodoxy, evidently implies a purely theistic point of view. A humanist. He was at the papal court, favored by these apostate anti-popes. Now we go on to read again in the History of Popes, from Volume 5 again. Although we must reject Machiavelli's picture of the condition of the church as a caricature, it is nevertheless indisputable that a considerable proportion of Italian clergy, from the mendicant friars to the highest dignitaries, were participators to a large extent in most of the evils that we have been describing. He's saying a lot of these guys that hated the church were mocking them to sort of ruin the reputation of the whole church. And unfortunately, what he's saying here is a lot of what they were saying was true. These monks and these religious people were committing these crimes. But that, as we always say many times, it doesn't take away from the purity of the church. Just like the Jews went bad in the Old Covenant era, that didn't take away from the purity of Judaism back then, or the temple, which was God's holy home at one time. So that's where these guys were making mistakes. But God was almost like using these rabidly anti-Catholic, self-nominal Catholics to attack these clerics, and the attacks were true. So it created a great scandal, and it causes a lot of people to fall out of the church, though. It's just horrible. And now we're reading here. That's what he's saying here about this. He says, the more intimately the church was bound up with the public and social life of the community, the more must the corruption of the world affect her, and its pearls menace her members. Cupidity manifesting itself in the prevalence of simony and accumulation of benefices, selfishness, pride, and ostentatious luxury were but too common among the ecclesiastics. The extent of the corruption is seen in the complaints of contemporary writers and proved by well-authenticated facts. Unhappily, the infection spread even to the Holy See. It spread. That's the worst of all, right? And you have to have the corruption of these apostate antipopes to allow this to continue. Even when the Holy See didn't have these vices themselves going on there, they were allowing it to happen in other areas, so they were just as guilty. The corruption begins with Paul II. It increases under Sixtus IV and Innocent VIII and comes to a head in the desecration of the chair of St. Peter by the immoral life of Alexander VI. It doesn't come to a head with him. He wasn't the worst guy. This is what they all try to prove. As I just told you about Julius II, who came after him, he practiced astrology, hired Michelangelo, that had perverted apostate pig, to put in moral art in the Vatican and idolatrous art. So it didn't come to a head. It's still going on even to today. And the pictures are still up there until today. Now we go. He goes on to say, the depravity of these times struck even such outside observers as the knight Arnold von Harfiff with horror. The lives of many cardinals, bishops, and prelates are a sad spectacle at a time when one man could hold any number of benefices and squander unabashed the revenues derived from them in a career of luxury and vice. The serious corruption in the College of Cardinals began under Sixtus IV. And during the reign of Innocent VIII, it increased to such an extent that it became possible by bribery to procure the election of such a successor as Alexander VI. And simony was practiced well before that, not just by the electing of the so-called popes, but even to get offices, bishops, and bishoprics and all that. It was rampant even in the 11th century. It goes way back. It didn't just start with these guys. I didn't quote yet, but Peter Damian will give us that testimony about how rampant simony was in his day, in the 11th century. At glance of the lives of Ippolito d'Este, Francesco Iloris, Cesare Borgia, and others is enough to show the character of the members admitted under the Pope into the Senate of the Church. It is not surprising when the highest ranks of the clergy were in such a state that among the regular orders and secular priests, vice and irregularities of all sorts should have become more and more common. The salt of the earth had lost its savor. Moreover, when moral purity languishes, faith cannot fail to suffer. He's wrong here. Faith suffered first. Then, see, this is where pastors are wrong, and this is where they're all wrong. They don't get the picture. Faith suffers, then it's the opposite. He's got everything backwards. He's putting the morals above the faith. The faith comes first. So he's wrong about this. Okay, so let me go on to say this. Which is, moreover, the moral purity languishes, faith cannot fail to suffer. Now, sometimes you might say this too, somebody could become moral. Like if you're a bad Catholic and you're very obstinately immoral and you don't confess, there are times when you could then go into heresy to justify your immorality. That can happen also. So it's sort of like you don't have the faith. This is, in general, the masses of people. They lack the faith, they're faithless, they're nominal Catholics, and they fall into massive sins of morality. Massive sins of morality also propel them into faithlessness also, if they're obstinate, because they want to make excuses for their immoral sins and come up with even more heresies, more sins against the faith. Now, and thus, when to this was added the influence of false of the Renaissance, many were led astray. It is a mistake to suppose that the corruption of the clergy was worse in Rome than elsewhere. Of course, it's all over the place. There is documentary evidence of the immorality of the priests in almost every town in the Italian peninsula. In many places, Venice, for instance, matters were far worse than in Rome. No wonder that, as contemporary writers sadly testify, the influence of the clergy had declined, and that in many places hardly any respect was felt for the priesthood. Their immorality was so gross that suggestions in favor of allowing priests to marry began to be heard, like you're hearing today again. They're trying to put down celibacy, but if that celibacy was good enough for 1,000 years, and the holiest men practiced it, I'm practicing, who's living like a pig, I'm practicing celibacy, not only is it possible, it's what the church demands for the priesthood, so they can devote all their time to God and not have to worry about a family. And it was practiced for 1,000 years, but they always come up with this excuse to try to attack the celibacy law, and so priests can then get married again. And all they always go into that issue, you know, as an excuse. That's not the reason. So you think if they're going to get married, they're going to get any better? They're going to be just as bad, just like married people are today. Most of your married people are committing adultery, fornicating with other people, committing sins of impurity. They're homos. They think that's the solution, right? Now, but that's, he's just sort of telling you how bad the priests were back then. Many of the monasteries were in the most deplorable condition. The three essential vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience were in some convents almost entirely disregarded. Too many regulars, says the Franciscan Roberto di Lecce, were monks in nothing but the name. The painter Fra Filippo Lippi and the novelist Brondello, though these men lived mostly at court, are instances of the sort of characters to be found in some monasteries. The discipline of many convents of nuns were equally lax. And again, we read from the History of Popes, Volume 5, there was certainly occasion enough for such remonstrances, considering the life Alexander was then leading and his partiality towards his family. It was about this time that Cardinal Parodi said to the Florentine envoy, "When I think of the lives of the Pope and some of the cardinals, I shudder at the idea of residing at the court. I will have nothing to say to it unless God reforms his church." Right, here's a guy that was right. I'm not going to say nothing to it. I'm out. I'm gone. That's what you got to do with these people. You can't be in any kind of religious communion with them. You can only deal with them in secular matters that are absolutely necessary to be in communion with them. You can't eat with them. If you still think he's the Pope because you don't have the deeper dogma, he's not the Pope. You obey all his just laws, but that's about it. Now we're reading also from History of Popes, Chapter 6, and from some evidence from the notorious heretic Savonarola. He was a notorious heretic because he held the heresy of Scholasticism, and he held several heresies, which one of them was he believed that infants who die of the original sin are happy united to God. That was the Aquinas heresies. So he himself, and he was a little bit too far on the right in other issues that were very bad. He was bad, but nevertheless, he said a lot of good things too. Even evil men can do good things. And he was railing against them very severely. And he was doing it more than most of the people of his time. And you can tell because they excommunicated him. He wouldn't go to the papal court. He didn't want to be in religious communion with the Borgia guy. And he denounced the Borgia guy by name. That's the thing that got the Borgia most angry at Savonarola. Not that he condemned the sins. They allowed a lot of preachers to condemn the sins. They did. Of the day, even. but they didn't want them to denounce them personally, the Noam Chomsky attack. If you attack them personally, they will come after you and say, I don't want you attacking us personally. You have no right to judge the Pope or the bishops. That was the big issue. So a lot of your guys only went as far as condemning the sins of the day, never denounced the apostate anti-popes who were committing these crimes. So they were guilty of non-judgmentalism itself. Savonarola didn't do that. He did denounce them. He even said, he says he's a pope. I don't think he's the pope. I don't want to be in religious communion with him. He was correct on all that. That's why they excommunicated him and burned him at the stake. So my point is, if you're a theologian or a preacher in those days, you're not going to be made a saint unless you're favoring these guys and you're not denouncing them. You know, if you did the right job, my point being is these apostate anti-popes aren't going to have nothing to do with you. They're going to burn you, let alone make you a saint. The saints are going to want to burn you at the stake. But anyway, we're going to quote from Savonarola a little bit at length here, where he does expose a lot of the crimes. Savonarola's second sermon was directed mainly against the vices of Rome. He began with a curious application of the passage of Amos 4:1. Hear this word, ye fat kine that are in the mountains of Samaria. For me, he said, these fat kine signify the harlots of Italy and Rome. Are there none in Italy and Rome? 1,000, 10,000, 14,000 are few for Rome. For there, both men and women are made harlots. And pursuing this strain, he describes the vices of Rome in terms scarcely to repeat it at the present day. He's a wimp, pastor. He hates it. He doesn't like it when he said something, their head should be taken off to be killed. He goes, oh, he went too far, Savonarola. He was correct. Savonarola, not only does he denounce, he also properly wants to punish them. He says they should be killed, and right, he's right. The pastor gets offended at that. He says he was too hard. He was right, you see. The guy who's right, they condemn. Pastor, some of these other preachers pastor talks about that he sort of likes, they condemn sin, but they don't really denounce the people personally nor tell them that they should be properly punished. You see this, if you guys pick up this book and read it, it's throughout his writings with this notorious heretic Ludwig Pasteur. He goes on to say, he says, both men and women were made harlots. In pursuing this strain, he describes the vices of Rome in terms scarcely to repeat it at the present day. Flee from Rome, he cried. Out. For Babylon signifies confusion, and Rome hath confused all the scriptures, confused all vices together, confused everything. 1400s. Accusations against Rome are constituted the principal theme of the Lent sermons of the year, 1497. The language of the preacher became more and more violent. Come here, thou ribald church, he cried out. The Lord saith, I give thee beautiful vestments, but thou hast made idols of them. Thou hast dedicated the sacred vessels to vainglory, the sacraments to simony. Thou hast become a shameless harlot in thy lusts. Thou art lower than a beast. Thou art a monster of abomination. Once thou felt shame for thy sin, but now thou art shameless. Once anointed priests called their sons nephews, but now they speak no more of their nephews, but always and everywhere of their sons. Concubinage, bastard kids. Everywhere hast thou made a public place and raised a house of ill fame. And what doth the harlot? She sitteth on the throne of Solomon and solicitous to all the world. He that hath gold is made welcome and may do as he will. But he that seeketh to do good is driven forth. And thou, O prostitute church, thou hast displayed thy foulness to the whole world and stinkest up to heaven. And elsewhere, I don't know if it's him, someone else says, you can't get anything done in Rome without gold. You can't meet nobody. You can't even have a conversation unless you have money. That's how bribes. A simple poor person who wants justice can never be heard even. That's somewhere else, I forget. Maybe you'll hear it in one of these things. Maybe even Peter Damian saying that back in his day. Savonarola's attack on the Italian clergy, and especially the Roman clergy, became more violent than ever. The scandals, he says, began in Rome and run through the whole of the clergy. They are worse than the Turks and Moors. In Rome, you will find that they have one and all obtained their benefices by simony. They buy preferments and bestow them on their children or their brothers, who take possession of them by violence and all sorts of sinful means. Their greed is insatiable. They do all things for gold. They only ring their bells for coin and candles. Only attend vespers and choir in office when something is to be got by it. They sell their benefices, sell the sacraments, mass stipends and stall fees, traffic in masses. In short, money is at the root of everything. When the evening comes, one goes to the gaming table, another to his concubine. When they go to a funeral, a banquet is given. When they ought to be praying in silence for the soul of the departed, they are eating and drinking and talking. They are steeped in shameful vices. But in the daytime, they go about in fine linen, looking smart and clean. Many are absolutely ignorant of the rule and where to find it, know nothing of penance or the care of souls. There is no faith left, no charity, no virtue. Formerly, it used to be said, if not pure, at least demure. Now, no one need try to keep up appearances, for it is considered a disgrace to live well. The guy who lives well is mocked at and laughed at. If a priest or a canon leads an orderly life, he is mocked and called a hypocrite. No one talks now of his nephew, but simply of his son or his daughter. They go openly to St. Peter's. Every priest has his concubine. All veils are cast aside. The poison is so rank in Rome that it has infected France and Germany and all the world. It has become to such a pass that all are warned against Rome, and the people say, if you want to ruin your son, make him a priest. All ye priests, Savonarola cried out from the pulpit on 1st March. You have surpassed the pagans in contradicting and persecuting the truth of God and his cause. All my children, it is evident now that they are worse than Turks. Now must we resist the wicked as the martyrs resisted the tyrants. Now you know why they didn't like him. He's going right at it, naming everything, punishing everything. Contend, ye evildoers, against the cause like pagans. Write to Rome that this friar and his friends will fight against you as against Turks and unbelievers. It is true that a brief has come from Rome in which I am called a son of perdition. Write that he whom you thus designate says that he has neither concubines nor children, but preaches the gospel of Christ. His brethren and all who follow his teaching reject all such deplorable things, frequent the sacraments, and live honestly. End quote. Of course, he was a heretic himself, which I got into later. But all these things he's saying here are true. And he's one of the ones that really came out with this full blast here. Now, there's a footnote here we're going to comment on. And it says, in his last sermon on the 18th March, Savonarola said that the only resource now left was an appeal to the highest tribunal. We must turn from the earthly pope to Christ, the heavenly pope. He declared that he had never set himself up against the true authority of the church, but if the power of the church is corrupted, it ceases to be that of the church and becomes the power of Satan. See, he's hinting at, almost getting the idea that he sometimes even say, is he a pope? I don't know if he's the pope. Well, there's the pope, or he's not the pope. I ain't going to listen to him. He's of Satan. See, he's right about that. He's not quite sure. He discusses about the deeper dogma. He knows that he may not be a pope. But in either case, he said, this is not the church. This is of Satan. When it encourages concubines, knaves, and thieves, and persecutes the good and hinders those who desire to lead Christian lives, I tell you then that it is a devilish power that must be withstood. Very true. So don't say it's not possible to do it. Here's one guy that was doing it. And I'm sure there were people even better than him that were doing this that weren't even heretical like he was, and they were against scholasticism even, and against his righty tendencies. And these guys you never hear about. Never. They're buried. If they wrote letters to Rome, they're either hidden or they destroy the letters to get rid of the evidence. Again, from the History of Pope, Volume 6, in spite of the precautions taken by Alexander, even the previous year, the insecurity of both life and property in city was frightful. Murders occurred nearly every day. The severest punishment effected no improvement in his condition, which indeed was not worse than that of most of the other Italian cities. See, murders and robberies. You can even walk around Rome. He says no matter what they did, even if they gave him the death penalty, it was still rampant. Why? Because of the sins against the faith that these guys themselves were committing, which they never acknowledged. I'm reading from the History of Popes, Volume 5. In the second half of the 15th century, a thoughtful observer could not fail to be struck by the alarming corruption which pervaded Italian political life. Statecraft was developing more and more into an organized system of overreaching and bad faith. To consider any engagement binding was looked upon as a mark of imbecility. They broke their vows even, engagements. Treachery and violence were the order of the day. No one accepted anything else, and all relations between various states and princes were poisoned by envy and suspicion. With a cynicism which is almost grand in its audacity, Machiavelli openly recommends a policy quote, which sets aside all considerations of morality and Christianity or of the divine providence or judgment, simply assumes that the end justifies the means, and bows down with unwavering allegiance before the idols of Ludovico Sforza, Lorenzo de' Medici, Alexander VI, Cesare Borgia, Ferrante of Naples, pursued this corrupt system. Again from History of Popes, of the worldly cardinals, Ascanio, Sforza, Riario, Orsini, Scalfanatus, Jean Dile Boule, Giuliano della Rovere, Savelli, and Rodrigo Borgia were the most prominent. All of these were deeply infected with the corruption which prevailed in Italy among the upper classes in the Age of Renaissance. And I say, when you have all those guys bad, all the other ones on there, even though they weren't as bad, share equally in their guilt for being in religious communion with them. So the whole of them, they were all apostate anti-cardinals. Not even the ones who didn't like what they're doing, but still stayed there and prayed with them and was in religious communion with them. For that alone, they share in the guilt of all these other guys. Let alone they didn't denounce them. Or maybe they denounced some of the things they were doing, but remained in religious communion. There was a gang of criminals and all these apostate anti-cardinals. That's all you're going to get there. They're never going to let a good guy in unless by an act of God, things are not going to turn around. By the conversion of an apostate anti-pope who kicks all the cardinals out, or God has some king come in and kill the whole hierarchy and replace it. We're going to now be reading from the so-called Catholic Encyclopedia, which really isn't Catholic, it's full of heresies and immoralities. But nevertheless, it has some truths in there. And we're going to be quoting from the article of Renaissance. An article was written in 1911. Humanism was propagated chiefly from Italian centers and by Italian and Greek professors. In 1455, the library of Pope Nicholas contained 824 Latin and 352 Greek manuscripts. In 1484, at the death of Sixtus IV, the Greek MSS had increased to 1,000. These illustrations may suffice to indicate the movement becoming universal throughout Catholic Europe towards recovery from all sides of the treasures of the past. Not for historical purposes, but to glorify them, because they loved them. Nicholas V had it in mind to make Rome the intellectual center of the world. His successors entered largely into the same idea. Pius II, Piccolomini, was a man of letters, not unlike the great Erasmus. Paul II, though severe upon neo-pagans such as Pomponozzo, did not condemn the classical movement. Alexander VI was a statesman, not a scholar, not an Italian. The fierce and splendid, that's all he says about him, but we know his crimes. The fierce and splendid, he was a humanist too. He had mythological things in his apartment, so. The fierce and splendid Julius II himself, without culture, gave commissions to Raphael and Michelangelo. From Leo X, his age receives its title. He was the incarnation of the Renaissance in its most brilliant form, and he was a Medici, Leo X. An extraordinary enthusiasm for antiquity had set in, combined with boundless freedom of opinion, with a laxity of morals which has ever since given scandal to believers and unbelievers alike, and with all festal magnificence recalling the days and nights of Nero's golden house. Churchmen in high places were constantly unmindful of truth, justice, purity, self-denial. Many had lost all sense of Christian ideals. Not a few were deeply stained by pagan vices. The temper of ecclesiastics like Bembo and Bibiana shone forth in the comedies of this latter cardinal as they were acted before the Roman court had imitated far and wide, is to us not less incomprehensible than disedifying. The early years of Aeneas Silvius, which is Pius II, the whole career of Rodrigo Borgia, the life of Farnese, himself as well as the Curia, these all exhibit the union of subtlety, vigor, and other worldly qualities, which leaves us dumb and sorrowful amazement. We may express in the words of Alari as a prodigious intellectual activity accompanied by moral decay, scholasticism. The more their brain started to become idolized, that's scholasticism. The brain's put on a pedestal, all right, and the faith is ignored, all right. It was accompanied by moral decay. The passion for ancient literature, then they went into glorifying mythology itself. The passion for ancient literature quickened and illustrated when the buried classic marbles were brought to light, simply intoxicated the generation. They actually loved these things. They loved the Zeus idols and all that. It wasn't historical. They loved it. Not only did they fall away from monastic severities, they lost all decent and manly self-control. But there is no denying that in its triumphant days, the Renaissance looked up to beauty and looked away from duty as a standard and the law of life. It had neither eyes nor sense for the beauty of holiness. When it is called pagan, we mean this corrupting anarchic influence represented more gracefully by genuine poets and men of letters like Politian, more grossly by such licentious singers as Lorenzo de Medici, by Poggio, Bandello, Artino, and a thousand others, who declared that the morals of Petronius Arbiter were good enough for them. At Rome, and indelible at Rome, an incredible liberty of discussion prevailed under the spell of Renaissance. Lord Acton quotes well-known instances. Poggio, the mocking, he's a big humanist, and he was at the papal court under popes. Poggio, the mocking adversary of the clergy, was for half a century in the service of the popes. Felfio, a pagan, unabashed and foul, was handsomely rewarded by Nicholas V for his abominable satires. Pius II had the faults of a smart society journalist, and took neither himself nor his age seriously. Platina, whom with Paul II quarreled on political grounds, wrote a vindictive, slanderous book. The Lies of the Roman Pontiffs, which, however, was in some degree justified by the project of reformation in head in members, constantly put forth and never fulfilled. Yet Sixtus IV made Plantina librarian of the Vatican. It is equally significant that The Prince by Machiavelli was published with papal license, though afterwards severely prohibited. So some popes approved it, afterwards other popes condemned it, proving that even if you had real popes, these popes can contradict one. The popes are not always right. They're not impeccable. These guys were all apostate anti-popes anyway. There was need of a revision, which is not yet complete, ranging over all that had been handed down from the Middle Ages under the style and the title of the fathers and the councils, the Roman and other official archives. In all these departments, forgery and interpolation, as well as ignorance, had wrought mischief and great skill. They were messing up the church fathers and the infallible decrees of the past. They were messing them up. They were going there and interpolating them, and they were to fit their own modern heresies and stuff, is what he's saying here. It was rampant. The Renaissance had indulged its pride of state, of knowledge, and of system, with disastrous consequences to our Christian inheritance. It trampled on the Middle Ages and failed to understand that in them, which was truly original, as we say, I think even the 11th century is considered the Middle Ages, and that was as evil as just as bad. That was really bad and started back then. So some of these guys don't push it back far enough. The Latin of Cicero, which Urban VIII cultivated, the meters of Horace, did grievous wrong to the prose and verse of our church offices, so far as they were altered. That's what we talk about, all these prayers we've seen being altered and stuff in here. Really mangled. Even down till today, of course. The showy architecture now designed, though sometimes magnificent, was not inspired by religion, but before long it sank to the rococo and grotesque, and it filled the churches with pagan monuments, disedifying celebrities. In painting, we descend from the heaven of Fra Angelico to the co-religiosity of Correggio. May lower still, for Venus, too, often masquerades as the Madonna. As you can see in this picture right here, where our Blessed Mother is sort of posing like the Venus. And most of the time, Venus is presented just as Venus, unabashedly, right out in the open. That's it. This recording was produced by Mary's Little Remnant, 302 East Joffrey Street, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, 87901-2878, and can be accessed on my website at www.johnthebaptist.us.